Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreeder. Today on episode 95, I'm joined by Dr. Anita Agarwal. She describes her transition from private practice to academia and lessons she learned from Dr. Don Gass as his former mentee and current editor of the Gass Atlas. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now honored to be joined by Dr. Anita Agarwal. Dr. Agarwal is currently at West Coast Retina in San Francisco, California, where she works with fellows and residents from California Pacific Medical Center, and also is an adjunct professor at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Dr. Agarwal, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jay.
So you're a new guest to the program. So usually what we do with new guests who are retina specialists, we cater a little bit to the residents, fellows, younger listeners who are listening to podcasts. We talk a little bit about your background. So how did you end up as a retina specialist or an ophthalmologist and then a retina specialist?
I grew up in India, and I wanted to be a physician since I was probably 3 or 4 years of age. And all along during medical school, I liked the widespread knowledge and widespread application of information towards diagnosis and taking care of patients. So I always thought I'd be an internist or a pediatrician. I like children, so I thought I was going to do pediatrics. And what I loved about medical school was the fact that we learned something in one branch of medicine, and then we could apply it to another branch, anatomy, physiology, all the clinical findings, and apply it to patients and connect system to another system. We had a strong group of dedicated teachers in medical school, and some of them were really good at syndromes and trying to quiz us about syndromes. And, you know, we trained in what are called government hospitals, where patients don't pay any money, so they're all admitted to the hospital. And clinically, we had excellent teaching and had a lot of patients in-house that we could examine at any time. And so we learned connecting clinical features to their disease and their findings very, very well. And I think that's one thing that is sort of we're missing that these days, because these days we order an MRI or a CT scan or some of the tests right away. And in fact, even in retina, we order an OCT before we even examine the patient. So those days, because everything had to be done by our clinical evaluation, we really put our mind and thoughts into every word the patient said and examined the patient from head to toe. And I think that has really held me in good stead. And during this time in India, medical school, internship was part of medical school. So during internship, because I was interested in pediatrics, all the pediatric residents would let me do a lot of procedures and take care of a lot of complex patients. And we didn't have a direct ophthalmoscope. We couldn't afford one. And the postgraduates had them, so they would lend me their ophthalmoscopes to go look into all these kids who were admitted with, say, tumors and things like that. And I was looking at all these eyes with papilledema with infiltrated tumors, and I was fascinated by the fact that I could see things in the retina, and I could see all the blood vessels, and I see what was going on. They were congested, they're hemorrhages. And then we got our first slit lamp at the government hospital, and I started looking into the slit lamp. And I was amazed at what we could see with at the lens, because, you know, prior to that, it was all examined with a flashlight, just a flashlight in the ophthalmology clinic as medical students. So that's where I decided retina was the way to go. So halfway through my internship, I decided I was going to change from pediatrics to ophthalmology. And really, I didn't like the optics of ophthalmology and other things, but retina was fascinating. And that's kind of what made me go into ophthalmology.
Which government hospital in India did you train at?
I went to a medical school in Mangalore. It's the Kasturba Medical College. And so we use the hospital in the city. So it's a government hospital with a lot of patients. And and the thing about medical school in India, it's a little different from here, which has its own advantages, but also has disadvantages. as med students, we were considered students. So we didn't really get hands-on until we became interns. But as I said, internship was part of medical school. So as medical students for 4.5 years, we were taught, we were sort of partly spoon-fed, which really kind of made us just think about studying. That's all we cared about, you know, learning and reading and going and seeing more patients and trying to make the diagnosis based on, say, heart sounds and everything else, and looking at the lungs and listening to all their lung sounds and things like that. We never really learned how to treat patients, which it's a plus, but not a plus. And I think the American training with actually getting hands-on is useful because you start thinking in managing patients during your med school, and we really learned managing only as interns. But as interns, we didn't have to worry about taking exams, studying, and things like that, but we concentrated on learning from our postgraduates or residents how to, and the attending, of course, how to actually manage patients. So the one thing is it was a longer course. It's 5.5 years of med school, which gave us that extra time. And I think that had some advantages. And I should say that I think will help me a lot. Because in India, you go to medical school at 18. You don't go to college. So we saved 4 years of college and spent 2 extra years in med school, which I think was useful. And I feel now with so much more knowledge, medical school for 4 years is too short.
Right.
That's why I think even in India, it's become, I mean, they don't spend as much time as we used to. We spend a lot of time learning in detail, which I think sometimes we have to relook at that and revisit and change the curriculum to some extent. Anyway, I guess that's another topic, but another time.
Right. So you do your training in India, then you come to the U.S.
After medical school, I went to Chandigarh for my residency, and that really was, medical school was good. We had fabulous teachers who were kind of, the time that they spent in the government hospital, they only spent teaching and seeing patients in the government hospital because they all had private practice in the evenings. So they didn't have practice in the mornings, and morning and afternoons they were in the hospital with us. So it was really a lot of focused teaching. And but when I went to residency in Chandigarh, India has about 3 or 4 institutes in the country at that time that were dedicated for exceptional training. One of them is in Delhi, one was in Chandigarh, one's in Jipmer Pondicherry, and one's in Bangalore. Bangalore one is only for psychiatry and neurology. These 4 institutes were autonomous institutes run by, funded by the central government, and everybody in the country could apply to those positions by taking an test. And the test was, of course, rigorous, and only a few people got in. And I was fortunate to match into ophthalmology there. And that really opened up my entire medical career to a totally different level. When they started this institute in 1963, all the people who were faculty were trained outside India had come back, were asked to come back and be part of this institute. Most of them were trained either in UK or in some of them in the US. And they set up a curriculum that is way different from all the other curriculum from other medical schools in India. And that, I think, opened up a whole new doorway for us, and it was intense. The institute catered for patients from about maybe 6 or 7 northern Indian states, and a lot of the sick patients reached there for their care because the standard was high, the facilities that were available was high, and the faculty were completely dedicated to just being at the institute. Of course, in India, there's no private practice, and the salaries are meager, but these professors were just part of the institute, and that opened up a whole bunch of new things for me. And there I had my first mentor was my the person that I whose unit I was trained in. His name is Dr. Amod Gupta. At that time he was an assistant professor, and he was the head of the unit that I was assigned to in the first 6 months. He Indian training, all of us learned a lot from reading journals and books. We didn't really have anybody who trained internationally except our chairman at that time, who had done his FRCS in London, and he was excellent, but he was a little strict, so everybody was scared of him. too much from him, except I mean, not, we learned from him, but we didn't have the courage to ask him any questions. We only learned one sort of one in one direction. And but he was brilliant. He was an awesome observant, and he published and he made these original observations that are still held on. You know, he said diabetic retinopathy does not occur in myopic eyes. You know, he made that observation. He talked about peridotic cataracts. He talked about smoking cataracts. He wrote all of these original papers that nobody even in the West had thought about at that time. He wrote a lot about Fuchs' spectrochromic cycloiditis, sympathetic ophthalmia, and VKH, and the connection between the two of them, that they have similar pathogenesis. And anyway, he was fabulous. He had gone outside India, whereas Amod Gupta, my mentor, who actually was my really great mentor, who continues to be my mentor now, he learned a lot by reading on his own. You know, he figured out things by looking at eyes and reading and looking at pictures and photography. And he, you know, in India, we didn't have dedicated photographers at that time to do a lot of pictures. So he, one afternoon, was right in the clinic day, and he would keep on taking photos of George and Andrew them and from the photos. So we'd line up all these patients, and they would all come in, and we'd keep on doing that. After they all left, then the photographer would develop those films, and we would pour over those films for the next 2-3 hours at the end of the day, and we'd figure out what's going on with these recurrent AMPs. And he learned about AP-MPP from the other professor, our chief, Dr. Jain, and he wrote, we didn't have a catalog for these images. They all got a phone number, and we had a register. We would enter the patient's name and put these fluorescein numbers on it. So they were all in these slots, and when we wanted something, we had to go back and look at the register and find all the diagnoses and then pull all the fluorescein and then put them back. Anyway, so the laborious process actually helped us learn a lot, because by the time we went to look and looked and looked, you start looking at it so many times that it sort of gets into your head. Anyway, he and I would pour over fluorescein angiograms for my thesis, and that's what we learned about what's going on in the fluorescein, what's going on in the early phases, late phases. And he was the one who introduced me to Don Gasser diseases. And he told me, you know, we had to do a thesis in India as part of residency. And I was looking to look at ophthalmic manifestations of lupus. That's what my I thought I'd pick that topic, because I was all excited that we could make diagnosis of lupus in residency. Anyway, he said, why don't you look at pigmented epithelial diseases? And So I started looking at all the AMPs, the VKH, the sympathetic, and geographic serpiginous choroiditis. And I picked these diseases, and I wrote a thesis and followed these patients for 3 years. And during that time, the multiple fluorescein angiograms that we did on them, we studied them in detail. And every paper or every little article that Don Gass wrote, I would scourge through whatever literature I could lay my hands on and read everything that Don Gass wrote. So that's how I got introduced to Don Gass's diseases. And by the time I finished my residency, it was my dream to ever come and meet Don Gass and see if I could be a fellow with him. And so that's how my interest in Don Gass's diseases started. And of course, it's history afterwards that I did manage to come to States and did manage to get a fellowship with him and much more. But my mentor really in India was Amod Gupta, my chief, who is now the world's leading expert on TB serpiginous and TB recurrent choroiditis. These were those patients that we followed at that time, and we didn't know at that time that this had something to do with antigenesis due to TB bacilli. And we would keep treating them with steroids, and every time we gave them the steroids, the disease would come back, and it ended up looking like serpiginous. And we called them recurrent AMP, going towards serpiginous, or recurrent multifocal pigment epithelialopathy is what we called it. Anyway, that now we know is really an antigenic response to TB, bacilli sitting in the pigment epithelium. And from there on, my interest in Don Gass disease started. And so one story is, you know, we couldn't get Don Gass's book in India. His atlas, he brought out the 1987 atlas. Those days you couldn't buy international books very easily. So very few of them were available. And it was so expensive that nobody would stock them. You know, and Amod, my chief, came to America for the first time when I was the first resident in his unit in 1987. And he spent a month at Rose, and at that time, gas was third edition of the Atlas had come out. And he came back and told me, you know, this book has come out, and just had a chance to just look at it, browse through it at the Rose Library. And I went down to my medical school for my holidays, and then I went to the reference library in my medical school, and I found a gas atlas. It was not available anywhere else but that library. So I bought it for half a day and copied the whole book. And copied it again, made one copy for my, gave one copy to Dr. Murgoff and kept the worst copy to myself. We could only read the text. We could not look at the pictures because they were so bad with the photocopying. But we read whatever we could from that book. And I carried it with me when I came to America and I showed it to John Gass. There's no way we could buy these books those days. Some books were available. A lot of the British books were available, but not American. I mean, we had a lot of American books, but somewhat. Like, Harris's was easily available, but Don Gass's book wasn't available.
So tell me about Don Gass, because we all know of him. I had never met him personally. I think a lot of the residents, but everyone knows his name, at least in retina and ophthalmology.
Yeah.
People know about the things he discovered, his work. How about Don Gass as a person, though, working with him one-on-one?
As a person, yeah. Don Gass, he's sort of multidimensional. He's the humblest and the kindest human being I've ever met. I'd say if there was Gandhi, and after that was John Gass. The euphony.
That's alphabetical, too.
True. Yeah. Because, you know, he was a simple man. He thought everything in a simple fashion. And but he had this, I was trying to see what I was going to tell you guys. I wrote it somewhere here, one word. I don't know if he was a mere mortal or he has some superhuman abilities that it always surprises me that sometimes in spite of everything, the amount of time I spent with him and I saw how he thought, saw how he worked and saw how he figured out, I think he had an uncanny ability that was way beyond what all of us who follow the normal bell curve can do. Because he had a very simple analogy. Everything was based on how he describes something. He says like a double bagel. If there was a CNVM on a CNVM, say that one was in the suborbital space, one was in the subretinal space, he called that a double bagel. And then he drew these little drawings. You go back and look at his drawings, and he said how the CNVM buds out. He drew these little things and made them into little, got little branches, then became a cartilage. How in the world did he figure those things out? You know, of course, he had a little bit of an advantage because he did ocular pathology. So he knew pathology, and he looked at these eyes that many of them were enucleated those days because people thought if there was a bleed, they thought it was a tumor, they'd take it all out. So he had the little advantage of that. But for him to use that towards things like type 2 juxtafoveal telangiectasia, he drew those things by hand. How in the world did he know OCT was going to come around 10 or 20 years down the road and it could show all the same things that he drew by hand? So I think there was something a little superhuman about him, which I think is true, because I don't think any of us can think about those things. Of course, he was sensible. He was very simple and thought about everything in layers. He was a pathologist, so he had all those advantages. But there was something a little extra that he had that none of us have, or very few of us have, that he could go beyond. He figured out type 2 juxtaposed telangiectasia was a Müller cell disease. I mean, that he discovered, he wrote about that in the 80s. I mean, in 1984, he drew choroidal neovascularization, a subretinal neovascularization going from the inner retina down into the subretinal space. His paper on juxtaposed telangiectasia was in 1984. And now on OCTA, we can show that. How in the world did he know that in 1984, right? So there's something unusual about it. But the one advantage that he had over Dick Green, Dick Green is an excellent pathologist who described and showed us a lot of pathology. But Dick Green was in the lab. He didn't have the advantage that Don Gass had of examining patients and seeing changes occurring in a given patient over time. So I think that's where Don Gass had a little edge over Dick Green in the ability to interpret the pathology and correlate it with clinical findings. And for example, is type 2 juxtaposed telangiectasia. There was an eye that was enucleated that was studied by Dick Green, and they wrote the pathology paper and they published it. Don Gass asked to borrow that histology, and he went back and looked at those slides, and he found blood vessels in the photoreceptor layer. And because, you know, as a clinician, he knew that these blood vessels from the inner retina were connecting down to the bottom and going down towards the choroid or towards the RPE. And that advantage he had because he was examining these patients. And he could see with the Ruby lens one, imagine or at least analyze and figure out that these things were going on underneath what we could see on the surface. And so that's how he went back, looked at that path, and he said, you know, the retinal vessels are growing into the photoreceptor layer, and now then they're going into the subretinal space and causing subretinal neovascularization in type 2 juxtafoveal telangiectasia. And I think he had 4 children, so he had a busy life. He still made time to write. Apparently, he would wake up in the morning. He would go off to sleep at 30 or 9 because many times he'd be asleep on the sofa. But he would be up at 4 o'clock earlier. I think 4 to 6 or 7, he would work his workshop in his office, write and go over everything, and then he would go to work. That was, I think, his routine. And he went on. He wouldn't stop. If there was something that got his interest, he wouldn't stop looking at it or thinking about it till he figured it out. So whenever he made slides for his talks, he would work on it pretty early during his preparation for a talk. And then he would redo the slides. Many slides would change and modify over the next, 10 days, 2 weeks, whatever it took to finish up all his talk. And I think because he was constantly thinking, he would never take anything just for face value, just make a slide and show, oh, here's a picture of this. He was always thinking to see why that was so, why this was so. And he would keep, in those days, you know, when we made PowerPoint slides, we had to get them all filmed. You know, we had to shoot on the negative and get the film developed. So the photographer would always tell me, don't bring them again for me to shoot them again. I'll tell him, hey, you know, in 4 days, you're going to change something else. So I can't help it. You got to do it. So we always have this sort of whatever conversation behind them. But that was him. He wouldn't stop thinking. And he never made his talk and slides and wrote his chapter and left it, said, oh, it's done. It was always evolving. And finally, he would get it all right. And then he'll go.
So, you know,
so what else can I tell you?
Well, you talked a lot about Don Gass and how he was describing these things that were not visible with the technology of the time, right? OCT corroborated a lot of his findings. And you mentioned earlier how, you know, you didn't have access to some of this technology when you were doing your studies in India, and even outside of ophthalmology, things like MRIs and neurology, but within ophthalmology, having an OCT and how when you don't have access, it makes you sometimes better clinically. You know, you've worked with fellows now, and I'm going to include myself in this generation, like the new generation, because of the pressures put on in terms of patient volumes, but not only that, but with EMR, we're not drawing, we're not doing the same sort of exams. And there's probably a happy medium, right? Because most of us don't feasibly have time to pull out a Ruby lens or a macular contact lens on all these patients. And maybe we don't have to with OCT. So
I agree.
What sort of balance do you teach your fellows or strike now in terms of, you know, obviously we want to be efficient. Obviously we want to be, use our technology to the best degree. But do you think that in training that people should try not to rely on these things, or realistically it's impossible nowadays?
Yeah, I completely agree. I think, you know, when I wrote the book and I was working on it, I remember Paul Stenberg, my chairman, telling me that, you know, I said, you know, this is nothing like what Don Gass would have done. I'm sure he could have been far more responsible. But he said, you remember, Don Gass didn't have to see as many patients as you had to see. He didn't have 4 days of clinic. And so they had time to actually study these patients in detail. So I think we definitely are an era where our workload is far more demanding, far more patients to see, find the EMR, which is one significant reason for me to leave academic university practice. Because I realized, you know, I'm a clinician. I do clinical practice. I do clinical work. And whatever I write is all understanding is from my clinical knowledge. I said I was just getting hammered by spending 3 to 4 hours every day after clinic to finish up my mundane paperwork. And that really drained me off all my energy to even think. And that was why I decided to transition off, because, you know, my collaborators had moved. And I said, you know, whatever I could do, I could collaborate clinically from a distance. And that really is why I shifted, because I just realized that my ability to think and be able to sort of when I think about new findings or to write a paper on something that I noted or saw, I just didn't have any time to do that. I had no energy left at the end of the day. And that's really why I put it out.
Now, I was going to say, it's the hidden irony of academics nowadays is it's almost counterintuitive. You would think that it would be the opposite.
Yes, but it is. It is amazing how the clinic workflow is much easier. I have a scrub. I finish my day and I'm done. I don't have any more papers to write. I mean, any more letters to dictate or any more letters to sign, any notes to finish. Nothing's left. Everything's finished at the end of the clinic, which gives me time to sort of unwind and write my other stuff, which I want to do, which is really the reason that I left academic. I mean, I left university practice. I wouldn't say I left academic practice, but I still feel that I miss some of the things. I miss all the diseases that I saw as inpatient diseases and things like that. But I want to write I'm writing the next edition of the book, and I wanted to spend time working on that rather than not have any time to write it, which is what made me make the transition. For the other question that you asked me is, in the present day, how do we combine ability to do a good clinical exam with using ancillary testing? What I do is, any new patient, I don't order any tests till I see the patient. And even if my followers interrupt me and say, hey, should I go to get this? Should I get that? I say, just wait. Because for me, if there's a test already done and I look at it, my ability to think and sort of go kind of think about the entire, explore the entire possibilities, suddenly I feel like it gets narrowed down and I can't think. Part of it is because you want to actually first examine the patient, because there's so many things, so many vitelliform changes, right? All the vitelliform changes, there's so many, at least 5 to 8 vitelliform diseases, they all look the same on OCT, and they look a lot of times the same on the photos. So how are you going to discern that one from the other? And that's based on history, the other little ancillary things that might go with it. So those are things that I don't want to shut my mind off. So I, to any new patient, I don't order any tests till I see the patient. Even if somebody sent me some tests, I don't look at those images. First, I take a history. Even if it's a rapid history of washing my hands in the room, I ask the patients, what did they first notice? Or how did it start? Because those are small little things that we can still use to help us arrive at a diagnosis. Everybody's now talking of PAM and Ferning and CRVO. It's not CRVO. Those eyes have poor vision. No CRVO that doesn't have macular edema will have 20/200 vision. It is ocular ischemia, it's retinal ischemia that's causing PAM and not CRVO. The veins are looking dilated and so dilated and sort of tortuous because there's poor blood flow on the vena, because the arterial flow is also narrow and the venous flow is obviously slowed down because there's nothing coming in front. So if we kind of isolate ourselves and think, oh, this is a CRVO, and we have to go back and think, why is the patient's vision counting fingers at 20/200 if it is a CRVO with no macular edema, right? So there is arterial ischemia. So things like that are the ones that I like to, that's conventional medicine where you put the history, the clinical findings, the vision, and everything together to come at the diagnosis. And what I do order, pre-order OCTs and all follow-up patients that I know that I want OCTs, say I'm injecting the injections to these patients. I don't do an OCT every visit. I do it every third visit, unless the vision changes. But I tell the technicians to work the patients up to check both eyes vision. If anything is altered, I look at both vision from the last visit to this visit. And if something's altered, I'll dilate them and take a look in the eye, in their eye. In fact, at Vanderbilt, I dilated everybody, irrespective of when they came. Everybody got dilated eye, because in case I had to look in there, I would have them already dilated. But I mean, you don't have to dilate them if you're just coming for an injection in one eye. But if the vision is changed in the other eye or in this eye, then I'll dilate and take a look in that eye. Because sometimes, we keep on looking at OCTs and say, oh, yeah, there's no fluid in the center, but there might be some fluid away from the center. And you miss that because you didn't look inside the eye. And the OCT scan, you looked only at the macro for the foveal scans. You didn't look at the entire cube. And I always get a cube. So any worries, I always look at the entire cube so that I know that I don't miss fluid somewhere else. So those are things that sort of you hybridize. You try to do something sort of pre-ordered and pre-tested, there before you actually see the patient. But you also have the ability to look at them a little bit more in detail. And I think that's the best way, though. At least that's the way I manage my clinic because I do want to have everything just, I see some of my partners get a picture every time, but they don't dilate them for a whole year. And I dilate them at the third visit. Every third visit, to dilate and take a look because you never know if there's a hemorrhage sitting somewhere else, if they got a suprachoroidal, a peripheral subretinal hemorrhage or something else that might pop up, and you don't want to miss those things. So there's a risk that you don't see because there's a center one that just shows you a vascular SPED, but there's actually a rip on the other side, and you might miss the rip that time, and the next time the rip might roll over. So for all those reasons, my rule is that I inject, if I make a plan for every third injection, I get imaging and then I dilate them. And I don't get imaging every month or every visit. If it's 5 to 6 weeks, the third time of the 6 weeks, I will dilate and get an imaging study. Because when I get an imaging study, I want to study the whole eye. I don't want to get one isolated from the other. So that way I can correlate the fundus appearance and the imaging finding. So that's kind of what I do. And like as I said, new patients, I first look at them before I order any test. Even if my fellow seems to say, hey, you want to do this? Then I'll go there and just do that. You know, what happens is because the photographers are not, some photographers are very good. They'll find other things, you know, but most of them will just scan the macula. And then you may have a lesion in the supratemporal quadrant. So there are someone who knows to be cut, they have to go back again for it. And then at least with mandibles, and you have glaucoma patients waiting for OCTs, other people, there are two retina doctors seeing patients, then they get behind the line again. So I don't want that duplication. So for efficiency and stuff, I just decide what all I need, because I might need autofluorescence, I might need something else. And I don't order every test. I mean, Don Gass, for the fact that he started fluorescence in such detail, at least by the time I was his fellow, he didn't order too many tests, you know. He wanted what he needed to make the diagnosis. And if somebody else had done a fluorescein and didn't send it, he would not put the patient through another fluorescein. He'd say, I will write to your doctor and ask him to send you images and I will take a look at them and I'll call you back. And of course, he had a little bit of luxury because his clinic had only 15, 16 patients that half a day. I'm like, all our clinics can have double the number of patients.
So you've been super generous, Agarwal, with your time. And so I just had one last question at the risk of opening a can of worms. And this is not a quick answer, but just your brief thoughts. You've done a lot of research or written with other collaborators on AREDS, the AREDS study, but also the genetics of macular degeneration. What do you counsel patients about genetic testing for macular degeneration? What patients do you put on AREDS? What patients do you not put on AREDS? For example, even though the AREDS study wasn't designed to look at prevention, there's a very frequent question where patients will ask who have a strong family history, should I be taking AREDS? What do you tell these patients and what do you tell them about genetic testing?
To me, when the AREDS study came out, looking at the most simplistic way of looking at something without all these confidence intervals and all sorts of all those statistical terms. The placebo patients, 20% of the placebo patients did not progress as expected. 29% of the patients who were on zinc and antioxidants did not progress as expected, or as not as if they weren't treated. Realistically, the difference was 9%. And so to me, and if you look at the visual acuity, a loss of 15 letters curves, the placebo ones are not too far off from the ones who got treated with antioxidants and things like that. To me, at least at that time, when we didn't know much about genetics and things like that, we thought this was only a very modest influence of any of the antioxidants and vitamins on AMD. So at that time, I would tell my patients who were young, that maybe it's worthwhile when you're young to take it because maybe over 20 years or 25 years, it has some protective value. But for somebody who is already 75, who has more than intermediate AMD, I said, I don't think this is going to get any. They have early GA. I mean, GA is already a late sign of AMD. And, Don Gass had taught me that the problem with AMD is in the choroid capillaries. What we see drusen is only the tip of the iceberg. So sequelae of something that's going on underneath. And not many eyes have drusen. These days we've discovered, that since we can treat them, there's so many patients who barely had any drusen. Finally come with a CNV. I mean, why is that? obviously they have some carotid cooling capillary going on that caused the CNV, but they haven't had any drusen in their eyes. So drusen is a good indicator, but it's not an absolute indicator of AMD. So my recommendation before we understood genetics and things like that was if they were young and they had drusen, at least intermediate drusen or sort of maybe one large drusen, and I would tell them, okay, take it because maybe in 20 to 25 years it has an effect. But I would never advise anybody who is about 70 or 75 to take AMD. I actually don't advise them to take vitamins. I give them the option. I tell them the study was done. I say that it's not absolutely, it's not going to harm you, but it may benefit you, and you can take it. And the reason is, you know, there's a balance in nature. Whatever all these antioxidants are studied for cardiovascular disease, this, that, and everything, nothing has really shown that makes a big difference. Our body will take in what it needs. It doesn't take in extra. People around the world have varying diets, and everybody's reasonably healthy, right? And so well, this one is there's a balance in nature. Nature is going to just get you to the median. It will not push you to one extreme or the other extreme. If you're deficient in something, you have some enzyme deficiency, that's a different matter. But most of us are reasonably healthy. I don't think taking the vitamins is going to modify this disease. And now that we know genetics of it, we know that there's so much more than just the genetics. I mean, there's such very gene defects that are contributing towards AMD. And there's obviously some epigenetic influence, whether there are protective genes or protective other factors, a whole bunch of new changes. And we are really targeting the disease way late in its course. If you're going to do something, you'll do it in their 40s or 50s, not in their 60s and 70s and 80s, not your 60s maybe, but even then, no. So my take is, you know, as vitamins, I really don't recommend it unless they're young. And I tell them maybe it's a value. We can't prove it, but it might be worthwhile taking. And I just tell my patients, good diet, exercise, wearing sunglasses is what you should do. And I'm really not a big proponent of either as to, you know, I think there's a balance in nature, and nature's not going to take an extra stuff, and I don't think those antioxidants are doing anything to the cord and the capillaries and things like that. My take.
Dr. Agarwal, thank you so much for your time. We went well over, but it was really interesting and fascinating, and I hope our listeners enjoy it as much as I did. So thank you again.
Thank you. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Jay.
Have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all our prior episodes on the website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. There are 95 episodes, including this one, on the website, sorted by category. You'll also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive Lessons from Our Pupils. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes, and at the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at RetinaPodcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback. That helps us come up with new episode ideas, and we appreciate any who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Dr. Agarwal for her time. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Benicasa, and Angela Chang for the great production. Finally, thank you, the listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, the conversations you inspire here each episode. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.